Hagman and Hagman Report. HagmanReport.com. That's our website. Hagman and Hagman for all of the show. Well, to access the show, HagmanandHagman.com. HagmanReport.com is our website. The reformatted Northeast Intelligence Network is coming alive again at HomelandSecurityUS.com. And there you have it. The bookmark, please, those websites, as well as subscribe to our YouTube channel. Just go to any one of the websites and click on the YouTube to subscribe. We ask that you do that because, you know, the censorship is pushing down search results. And, of course, that's not good. It's never good. Folks, do you need a fascinating speaker for your next conference, dinner, banquet, or church event? Here's the place to go. Okasa Media for speakers. Okasa Media. Okay. Okasa Media, their speakers bureau is second to none. I'm going to give you a phone number. All right. 305-396-2806. That's Okasa. And I'm going to spell that for you. O-C-A-S-O Media. M-E-D-I-A. All right. Their phone number, 305-396-2806. If you need a fascinating speaker. In fact, like the gentleman that's coming on right now, I read this book when it first came out well over a decade ago, and then a new version was just released here a number of months ago. Well, last year now, but still a number of months ago. I Heard You Paint Houses. In fact, it was re-released with an updated 57-page conclusion. This is about one of the most interesting conspiracies of the interesting mysteries, I guess, of the 20th century that happened on July 30th, 1975 with the murder of Jimmy Hoffa. Now, people might say, well, how is that relevant to today? It has many of the underpinnings of the template of organized crime is still in operation today. And you'll learn a lot from that. Our guest coming up is Charles Brandt. This gentleman, I have a lot of respect for. He's incredible. He was born and raised in New York City. He's a former Queens Junior High School teacher, but he became a welfare investigator in East Harlem, a homicide investigator, a prosecutor, chief deputy attorney general of the state of Delaware. He was in private practice since 1976. Charles Brandt is the past president of the Delaware Trial Lawyers Association. And he was named by his peers as one of the best lawyers in America. That's a title that is not given lightly. He's a frequent speaker on cross-examination and interrogation techniques for reluctant witnesses. As a matter of fact, he wrote another book, which is a fabulous book as well. I have that too, The Right to Remain Silent. It's a very... It's an incredible book. It's a detective thriller based on major crimes that our guests solve through interrogation techniques. And as a matter of fact, I just want to mention this real quick here. Former President Ronald Reagan wrote to our guest, Charles Brandt, an unsolicited fan letter about that book for forthright stand on improving protection of law-abiding citizens, The Right to Remain Silent. It dramatically challenges the Miranda rule restrictions on the use of interrogation by U.S. law enforcement. This gentleman is, again, one of my heroes. I look up to this guy. He has no clue who I am, but I've got his books, and we're going to be talking about the updated book, I Heard You Paint Houses, the 2016 edition, with the updated 57-page conclusion. Mr. Brandt, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for your very generous introduction to your audience. I appreciate it.
Well, no problem. I've read your latest, your updated book. I Heard Your Paint Houses. I know the story. So it's gonna be kind of hard for me to kind of walk through this without spoilers. But I can say this though. One thing I can say, I'm pretty sure without it actually being a spoiler. Your book is going to be made into, or is in the process of being made into, a major motion picture. Martin Scorsese is the man behind, along with Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci. So it's kind of pretty interesting, as a matter of fact.
Don't leave out Al Pacino.
Oh, Al Pacino. That's right. I forgot about him too. Yes,
a great line.
Pesci's going to play the mafia boss Russell Bufalino. Pacino's going to play Jimmy Hoffa. Bob De Niro is going to play Frank Sheeran, the Irishman, and the hitman for Bufalino and a hitman for Hoffa. And quite a cast.
Wow. Yeah. And as I understand it, you met with Mr. Scorsese and I believe Robert De Niro. It's supposed to be for an hour meeting. You ended up spent like 4 hours with the pair, right? And with somebody else, I think.
Also with them was the screenwriter Steve Zalian, who won an Oscar for Schindler's List, wrote American Gangster, and on. He's a great screenwriter. And so it was a meeting at a hotel in New York, supposed to last an hour, and it lasted 4 hours. And part of the reason it lasted, just the four of us in a hotel room at the Park of Meridian on 57th Street. And part of the reason that it lasted so long is that we had a lot in common. I grew up Italian, although my last name isn't. I didn't know my father's parents. They were gone before I was born, and my father was assimilated into my mother's gigantic family, Italian family. And so I was raised Italian in New York City, and I would have been a year ahead of Scorsese in high school, 2 years ahead of De Niro. And we had the 1950s to talk about, much less the movie up here. Common.
Oh, just to have a seat at that table would have been fun. That's for sure.
Oh, for sure.
Well, and folks, Mr. Brandt's website is Charles Brandt, B-R-A-N-D-T, author.com. And I really highly recommend this, all of his books, but this one in particular, I Heard You Paint Houses. And that is a line. I'm going to let you take this away because I love your style. I love your narration of this story. I've listened to it several times on several different venues. What does that mean? I heard you paint houses. Just go ahead and run with that.
Yes, sir. Frank the Irishman Sheeran had 411 combat days in World War II when the average was 80. And he was in General Patton's killer division. They had the most atrocity charges brought against them of any other division. And Frank came out of that a seasoned veteran who, when a lieutenant said to him, take this prisoner behind the lines for questioning, he would do that. But if the lieutenant added the words, and hurry back, that meant you take him some short distance and you kill him. And so that's what he did during the war. He was not a bad man. He was following orders, and he grew up a pretty decent fella. His father had studied for the priesthood for 5 years, and his mother went to mass every morning of his life. And one day he was driving a truck for Food Fair, which is a chain of supermarkets in those days. And he was in upstate New York, and his truck broke down at a truck stop. He couldn't get it started. And this little Italian man came over to him and offered to get it started for him. Well, the little Italian man was the powerful mafia boss, Russell Bufalino, who was also a master mechanic. So he started the truck, and Bufalino was taken by this 6'4", 220-pound, solid human being with the edge of combat. And he courted Frank into his way of life, which was the life of the mafia. Frank became a very trusted right hand to Russell Bufalino. And one day, Frank said to Russell that he had seen the movie On the Waterfront, and he thought he'd like to get into union work. He was then a union truck driver, Teamsters Union. Well, shortly after that, they were sitting at the Friendly Tavern in Philadelphia, a mob hangout in those days, and the phone was brought to the table. Bufalino said hi to whoever was on the other end of the line, and then handed the phone to Sheeran and said, say hello to your union president. It was Jimmy Hoffa. And the first words Hoffa uttered to Frank the Irishman Sheeran, and they were to become lifelong friends, lifetime friends, And Sharon became a huge supporter of Hoffa's. And the first words uttered to Frank were, "I heard you paint houses." And that means I heard you kill people, that the paint is the blood that spatters on the walls and the floor. And Sharon replied, "I do my own carpentry work too, which means I dispose of the bodies." And he had been doing that work for Bufalino. And now Bufalino was lending him to Hoffa. Hoffa had just become president of the Teamsters, and there were people that he felt he needed to get rid of. And so he flew Frank to Chicago. They flew Frank to Chicago, and Frank began his career as a hitman for both Bufalino and for Hoffa, but also, as close as he was to Bufalino, he became even closer to Hoffa. And that answers that question.
That does.
Going on. You got to stop me once in a while.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think it's important to, just for people to understand that, and you've characterized Frank Sheehan as having a Huck Finn kind of lifestyle, or it's been characterized that way. So he had a rough childhood. He grew up in a tough Philadelphia area before his Army stint. He got in a fight every day on this to and from school, basically. He had to fight his way to and from school, that is. And then, of course, as you pointed out, 411 combat days when the average was 80.
Well, I was just going to say, this is a biography of the man. It's not simply what happened to Hoffa. That might be four chapters in the book, as you know. But it's a biography of this very complicated man. He was not just an ordinary thug. He didn't know what the Mafia was until he met Russell Bufalino. And in fact, in those days, America didn't really know what the Mafia was. And
That's true. Very true. And imagine, in reading this book, and the book is so well written, and again, the name of the book is I Heard You Paint Houses, the story of Frank or Jimmy Hoffa, but so very well written, and it really provides insight into the operation of the time. Just imagine sitting there as a truck driver and head of the union is on the other end of the line. So, yeah, it's just an amazing time period, too. Okay. All right. Wow.
And
okay.
The book is based on nearly 5 years of tape-recorded interviews that I did of the Irishman, Frank the Irishman Sheeran. The movie right now is on the working title of the Irishman, but they're going to revert to the title of the book when they release the movie. Just for working title purposes, they call it The Irishman. So if anybody Googles it, you'll find The Irishman. But when it comes out as a movie, it'll be I Heard You Paint Houses.
Gotcha. So I
spent close to 5 years with this man, and we went everywhere together. I went to Mafia social clubs with him. And there's one photograph in that you mentioned the new version, which came out in July of 2016 with the additional 57 pages. And those 57 pages are stories I couldn't tell before in the other two editions of 2004 and 2005, because I would be talking about very dangerous men who were then still active. But by the time 2016 rolled around, those men were either dead or in prison or had become cooperating witnesses in one very important situation. So I was able to tell some stories I couldn't tell before, but also a lot of corroboration of what Sheeran told me had come to light and come to my attention. And so that's included in the new edition of the book.
Okay.
And so,
but it's
not only based on what he told me. A lot of it is in his own voice. He was a very articulate, often humorous guy. And I get credit for some of the lines in the book, such as one that I get credited for a lot is he couldn't fight to keep his hands warm. People say, "Boy, that's a great line." And I say, "I know. I wish I had said it." It was Frank's line. You know? And so much of the book is in Frank's own voice, as you know. Not every other chapter, but I set it up with my narrative, and then Frank gets to talk, and you get to hear him.
Exactly.
And I've got all that on tape. In fact, the FBI had subpoenaed my tapes, and when they sent them back to me, they sent me tapes with the FBI case number on it and the very, very formal Federal Bureau of Investigation labels on it. You know, it was very
sure.
nice.
Sure. Yeah. I've seen that before. Okay. So the way you got into this, here you are at your law office. It's my understanding in Wilmington, Delaware, and the phone rings, right?
Correct.
You get a call.
Go
ahead.
Well,
yeah. Just take it from there.
The whole country kind of knew that Frank the Irishman Sheeran was a prime suspect in Jimmy Hoffa's disappearance, even though they were like family. The FBI had figured out who was involved by way of informants. They didn't know how they were involved. They didn't know what the characters had done, but they identified 8 participants in the Hoffa disappearance in a memo called the Hoffex Memo, prepared by the case agent for the FBI, a fellow by the name of Bob Garrity. I got to know Bob after the book came out. In fact, it was after the paperback edition came out. He came to a book signing of mine, and he said, "Make it out to Bob Garrity." And I said, "I know that name. Who are you?" And he said, "I'm the Hoffa case agent." He said, "I read your hardback twice." He said, "We always liked cheering for it, but the Hoffa family thought that the sun rose and set on Frank Sheeran." And here's a man as close as he was to Hoffa. In fact, he was quoted in the New York Times as saying, "I'll be a Hoffa man till they pat my face with a shovel and steal my cufflinks." And it was this man that I was traveling with, and I was helping him unburden the guilt he had. He was forced to kill Hoffa by Russell Bufalino, and he said to me, "If I ever said no to Russell, you and I wouldn't be sitting here today talking. Jimmy would be just as dead, and I'd have gone to Australia with him." And going to Australia means being buried, you know, going down under.
Sure.
And so, you know, he was plagued by that, and not so much by some of the other murders that he committed, because some of these people deserved it. They violated mafia rules, and they stole, or they did something they shouldn't have, and he was sent out to kill them. Those they bothered him, but not like having to turn on his mentor.
Wow. And this is something I found very interesting, because I know that you taught interrogation, and a couple of statements you've made. And I'm not sure if it was in the book or in interviews or whatever, but they want to tell you, meaning, and I think you quoted one of your instructors, when you have a suspect or you're talking with a suspect or whoever, people want to tell you, and they want to talk in so far as unburdening themselves.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And this is kind
of
what...
That's in the conclusion chapter. When the detective, Wilmington police detective, who was very good at getting confessions, and I wanted to learn from him, and I said, "You know, how do you get these confessions?" He said, "They want to tell you, child."
So, wow, this is incredible. And folks, we're talking, our guest is Mr. Charles Brandt. His website, Charles Brandt, B-R-A-N-D-T, author.com. It's in our program description. And I highly recommend getting his book, I Heard You Paint Houses. I personally like the actual physical book, but it's available in multiple formats.
Number one New York Times bestseller.
Yep, that's
and,
right.
Yeah, it just has excellent reviews. I have not read the book myself, but I listened to some of the interviews that you were listening to earlier, and this is just some fascinating stuff. I love this subject matter.
And you know, Jimmy Hoffa was one of the most powerful figures in politics. He's a major figure in American politics. Many people may not know who Hoffa was today. You know, the millennials.
Yeah.
You know, but
I think they recognize it for the case being open never finding the body, never being solved.
Exactly.
He was a huge labor leader. And for folks who have Netflix, there's a movie with, I think from the 80s, with Jack Nicholson that it's just called Jimmy Hoffa, and it's pretty interesting. And doing some research on it, it's a big part of American history. It deals with Kennedy and the mafia and the labor unions and the corruption. within our government.
Exactly. Yeah. But I'm going to tell you the defendant.
And crazy Joey Gallo.
Oh, that's, yes, yes. who was Gallo? Yeah,
Crazy Joey Gallo was a kind of renegade member of the Colombo crime family. And he decided he wanted to have his own crime family, the Gallo family. And he was gunned down in Umberto's Clam House on Mulberry Street in New York's Little Italy in 1972. And that was a huge hit. I was then a homicide investigator in Delaware when it happened. And in those days, nobody took seriously the notion that you could solve a mob hit, that no one would want to be a witness. And he was such a well-known renegade. One of the lines of his that was then rolling around and was kind of famous, Bobby Kennedy had subpoenaed him during some labor racketeering before Kennedy became attorney general. He was chief counsel to the labor rackets committee, and he subpoenaed Joey Gallo, and Joey Gallo went to Kennedy's office and looked at the rug and said, hey, this rug would make a great crap game.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, what happened was that the prevailing story was that Gallo was celebrating his 40th birthday party at Umberto's Clam House, and three Italian hitmen came in and opened fire on him. They shot his bodyguard, the Greek, in the butt, and shot Gallo numerous times, finally killing him. He ran outside of the club, of the restaurant, Clam Bar, and was finished off in the street on Hester Street and Mulberry Street in Manhattan. And the word then was that three Italians had rushed in and opened fire. There were two movies made of Joey Gallo. One, Peter Boyle, if you remember him, he was the father on Everybody Loves Raymond.
Oh, yeah.
He was the monster in the humorous Young Frankenstein, a very accomplished actor. He played Joey Gallo in one of the two movies, and I forget who played Joey Gallo in the other movie, a kind of lesser-known Italian actor, but somebody, you know, that we would, whose name we'd recognize. Anyway, in both of those, he was killed by three Italians, and in all the articles on that, and all the books, there were a number of books about Crazy Joey, and they all had him being killed by three Italians who burst in. Well, in the new edition, there's a photograph that isn't in the prior editions. It's Frank and me at a benefit for a retiring teamster, and it's a table full of beer bottles, and somebody just took a snapshot of, really, they were trying to get a picture of the legendary Frank Sheeran at the head of the table, and they got a picture at the precise moment that Sheeran had confessed to me that he had killed Gallo and that he had done it by himself. And there's a little look of Sheeran withdrawing a little bit, as he always did when he confessed something new to me. And as me, you can see, you can't see the tape recorder, but you can well imagine that what I'm doing, I'm leaning in on him to make sure that I get this on tape, despite the beer bottle noise in the background. And so we had that. I had that. My publisher had that. And I had him, as I mentioned, for 5 years, I had him to myself. And I didn't just have him on the witness stand for an afternoon. So if he told me he killed Gallo, I then challenged him on it, and then challenged him again on it. And he convinced me without question that it was he was a lone gunman and he had killed Gallo. And it went against 6 or 8 books. It went against 2 movies. It went against, you know, profiles in the New York Times and that sort of thing. But he stuck to his guns. Well, the hardback came out, and the hardback has a picture of Frank about the age he would have been when Gallo was shot in Umberto's. And it turns out that an editor, a big shot editor at the New York Times, she was at the time that I got to meet her, she was the national assignment editor, which meant that nobody wrote an article about that had anything to do with our nation, as opposed to international articles, unless she assigned it. She was a very big deal. And the people in the newspaper racket knew that she had been there that night. She'd been an eyewitness to it. She didn't come forward. She was there with her girlfriend, her girlfriend's brother, and the brother's wife. And, you know, New Yorkers know, stay out of the way when there's a mob hit, and don't offer any identifications, please. So they beat it out of there, the four of them. But everybody in, you know, who knew her knew she had been there that night. They also knew that she didn't like to talk about it and that she didn't read anything about it. She didn't see any of the movies on Gallo. She just stayed away from it. Well, somebody, one of the old-time newspaper reporters, called her attention to the photograph here.
Mr. Charlie, Brent, I don't mean to interrupt. Yeah, I'm going to stop right there for just for a three-minute break here. Yeah, didn't mean to interrupt there. Folks, you're listening to author Charles Brand, his website, charlesbrandauthor.com. We're going to be right back, 3 minutes. Don't go away.
Visit HagmanReport.com for the news and articles that matter most. Stay tuned. We will be right back.
There shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time. No, nor ever shall be.
Folks, I'm going to direct your attention to MasterPreps.com. MasterPreps.com. Wow. MasterPreps.com, the sponsor of our show, MasterPreps.com. That's MasterPreps.com. Take a visit there. High-quality items, made-in-America items. I mean, anything, everything you possibly want, from cooking utensils, cooking frying pans. It is. It'll blow you away. Absolutely, Eric said.
It's insane. I mean, wow. Look at the products.
Folks, visit MasterPreps.com. Again, welcome to the Hagman and the Hagman Report family. MasterPreps.com. I mean, wow. It's insane.
MasterPreps.com. Are you ready for what comes next?
Hi, I'm Grace Gonzalez from Trang Close in the Woods. We are an American family-owned company founded and built on skills and knowledge gained from responding to 18 major disasters in the U.S. and around the world. We found that most people don't have enough food and water to survive, let alone any medicinals to save their life. We're offering 25% off our must-have American Heritage Armies kit. It contains 12 homeopathic armies, a booklet that goes over everything in your kit, and our brand new book, Major Disasters Lessons Learned. Just enter coupon code HAGMAN. In life or a disaster, you must be able to take care of yourself. You may not be a medical doctor, and your grandmother and your great-grandmother probably weren't either, but they still knew how to minister to their family's health issues, and so can you. Check out our American Heritage Armies kit at www.changelessonwoods.com. Your life may depend on it.
Hello, everyone. This is Joe Charles, the guy whose voice is heard announcing for the Hagman and Hagman Report right here on YouTube and across the Global Star Radio Network. There have been many people wondering whose music is being played during those breaks. Well, you guessed it. And we're very pleased to announce that all that music and 11 brand new songs from the CD New Jerusalem is set for release on April 10th for download on iTunes. That means you can help support my ministry and be blessed by this awesome, inspiring recording. I have been fortunate to work with some phenomenal musicians from around the world that helped us put this recording together in the studio. Simply go to joecharlesmusic.com and click on the iTunes link. Or, if you'd rather have a CD, we'll send one right out to you. Just leave me your email and we'll get right back to you. And thanks to Doug and Joe Hagman for making this all possible. God bless.
Yeah.
And welcome back, folks, to this edition of the Hagman and the Hagman Report. One last segment with Charles Brandt. Mr. Charles Brandt, charlesbrandtauthor.com. Right up to the top of the hour we've got, and this is such a delight for me because you've heard of Jimmy Hoffa, you've heard of his mysterious disappearance on July 30th, 1975, you've heard of all kinds of conspiracy theories, all kinds of theories, but you know what, folks? You want to know what really happened. You want to know the details of the man, of the men involved, the man himself, Charles Brandt, really has done the job. And with the new updated conclusion that was just released just last year, it also includes independent evidence forever corroborating Frank Sheeran's confession to the Hoffa murder provided by an FBI cooperating witness, the former boss of the Buffalino Mafia family, the Crazy Joe Gallo murder provided by Ms. Ryan was saying, a respected New York Times editor who is an eyewitness to the Gallo murder and to participating in the Mafia, listen to this, conspiracy to assassinate President John F. Kennedy in Dallas. Also, that was provided by statements made by New Orleans and Dallas to territorial Mafia boss, it's Friday, Mafia boss Carlos Marcello and Robert F. And by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the son of Marcello's archenemy, Bobby Kennedy. And as right before the break, Mr. Brown was discussing the Gallo murder, exactly, at Umberto's and the witness and such before we rudely cut him off. So, Mr. Brown, go ahead and pick up where he left off.
Okay, I'll try to wrap it up quickly, that segment of it anyway. This New York Times editor looked at the photograph of Sheeran and said, "This gives me chills. That's the man who killed Gallo." And so I then got in touch with the ex-cop, a retired cop, Joe Coffey, who wrote a book himself called The Coffey Files. Anyway, he was the homicide investigator that investigated the Gallo hit. So I called him up and said, here's what I have. I have this woman. And I was a homicide investigator myself, so I'm calling him colleague to colleague. He said, "Well, you've solved it." He said, "We left the story out there that it was three Italian gunmen as what's known as an integrity test, so that if an informant comes forward and wants to sell information about where to find these three Italians or who these three Italians are, we just throw them out of the office because, we know it was a lone gunman and we knew he wasn't Italian." And so, that was very gratifying to have that in the face of long odds. I actually had been advised by one of the editors to leave the Gallo hit out of the book because there was so much other material stuff that if, we're going up against two movies and several books and the prevailing belief, I said, no, if I'm wrong, and I know I'm right, because I was there when he confessed it to me, and I have a photograph of it, and that photograph is in the new edition of the book.
But
I wanted, if you don't mind, I'd like to answer a question you asked me earlier, and then
sure.
I got a little carried away, and that was you had the setup of me sitting at my office, and I get a phone call. You recall that question?
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, what had happened then was that I had, as stated earlier, I'd been a homicide investigator and then a homicide prosecutor, chief deputy attorney general of Delaware. Then I went into private practice, and my goal was to become a medical malpractice lawyer. I had that in my mind for a long time, but it takes a long time before you can earn a living at that. And so I did some criminal defense work. And I was then in the role of a medical malpractice lawyer when I got a phone call from a man named Franny McDonald, who was an associate in the Angelo Bruno crime family of Philadelphia. Angelo had Philly. Russell Buffalino was the boss of all the rest of Pennsylvania, upstate New York, parts of New York City, and parts of New Jersey. He was also the man that all the rest of them looked up to. He was not on... He was not seated on the commission, because when the commission was set up, it was the five families of the heads of the five families of New York. But the commission did nothing of any consequence without Russell's approval or Russell's planning. And so I get this call from one of Angelo Bruno's men, Franny McDonald. Frank Sheeran was in prison. He had gotten 32 years worth of sentences, consecutive sentences, and was doing his time. He was 70 years old. And they wanted me to get him out on medical grounds, early parole on medical grounds. You know, that was my field, medical malpractice. And it was easy. He had severe spinal stenosis and an arthritic condition of the spine that was impinging on his spinal cord. He had to go around in a wheelchair, and he needed surgery. And the prison itself was happy to release him. Why he was doing 32 years, it's because he was one of those eight men on Bob Garrity's HopEx memo, the suspects in Hoppe's disappearance. And the FBI hounded those men the way they put Al Capone in jail for tax evasion. They got them for whatever they could get them for. And in Frank's case, it was labor racketeering. And I can tell you that anyone else would have gotten 5 years. He got 32 years. The FBI was trying to put pressure on all of these men to see who would crack. And so I get this call to get him out. And I do. It was pretty easy. I filed the necessary papers. We had the hearing. And he gets released. Well, he then takes my little paralegals and me and my junior partner to an Italian hangout, Italian restaurant, Vincenzi's, a mafia hangout, in a private room with a table full of eight guys named Rocco, Frank Sheeran, me and my little staff. And these guys are talking about how amazing it is that they're still alive and how much they hate the FBI agent, Quinn John Tam, who had hounded Sheeran into a 32-year sentence. I ended up shaving like 15 years off his sentence as a result of his medical condition. And so we're having this luncheon. We don't really fit in, you know, we're listening. And after the luncheon, Frank takes me aside. And he said that he's tired of being written about in all the books on Hoppe, because that HopEx memo was released, leaked, and so these authors had it. Stephen Brill and Dan Moldea and some other authors had it, and it was the basis of these books that came out in 1978, 3 years after Hoppe's disappearance. And Sheeran was prominent in all of them as participating in the Hoppe's murder. By then, everyone knew it was murder. But they didn't know what he'd done. And here he is telling me he's tired of being written about in all the books on Hoppe. All the articles on Hoppe had him listed. Sheeran was profiled in the New York Times, profiled in Newsweek magazine, and everywhere as the number one suspect in the Hoppe disappearance. And he said he was tired of it. And he said to me, you know, I read your book, The Right to Remain Silent, in jail. And that was the book that Doug mentioned earlier that was based on homicides that I solved through interrogation. And it's a novel. It's fiction. It's a detective story with a detective named Lou Razzi. But the dialogue in it is the stuff I did, you know. And I wrote it from memory. So it's actually my favorite book. It got really very well reviewed. TriStar Pictures took an option on it, but then as it goes in Hollywood, I don't remember exactly what happened, but they never did make the movie. But in any event, if anyone's interested in that book, they can order it on my website, Charles.
And I got to tell you, Mr. Brandt, that to me is it's relevant. And I understand how you wrote it, but it's relevant today. People can get a lot out of that book right now, The Right to Remain Silent.
Oh, that's sweet. I hope so. I meant it. I meant that to be the case, that it would influence people's perspective on certain criminal procedures.
Yes.
Anyway, Frank tells me he read my book, and he also mentioned that to me, that he had seen that Ronald Reagan had praised it. It was publicized in the paper. And it's a Law and Order book. it has a line of dialogue in it that confession is a basic human need like food and shelter. It's not a book where the cops are the bad guys. You know, it's a book where the cops are the really, really good guys. And
right.
Aaron said to me, "I read your book, and I wanna write a book. I'm tired of being written about as being involved in the Jimmy matter, that he would call it, and I want you to write it." As soon as he said that, I knew in every instinct in my fiber that this man has something he wants to get off his chest. Guilt and a burden that he's carrying around with him. And I said, "Sure, let's meet." So we scheduled a meeting at his apartment in Springfield, Pennsylvania. He was walking with a cane. He didn't have his surgery yet. But there's a picture of him in the book sitting in a wheelchair. And he looks so tough, if you recall that picture.
I do.
Sitting in his wheelchair. You wouldn't fight him in a wheelchair. And so I go there, knock on the door. He answers it, and there's a man in a suit behind him. And I think, oh, no. If you're going to interrogate somebody, you're going to question somebody, you don't need a third party there. You don't want a third party there.
Right.
And he says to me, he says, "This is my lawyer, Charlie Brandt. This is my other lawyer, Jimmy Lynch the Catholic." Jimmy Lynch the Catholic? And he reaches out his hand and says, "Hiya, Charlie, how you doing?" So I go to the bathroom. And while I'm in the bathroom, the phone rings. I come out, and Sharon's on the phone. And in those days, he was wearing a uniform of sweatpants and a sweatshirt, And he hung up, and he turned to Jimmy Lynch, and he said, "That matter? We got to do it now." "Now? Yeah, you do it. If you want it, you do it when they want to do it, not when you want to do it." So Frank went in and changed his shirt, got into something a little more presentable, came back out, and Jimmy Lynch said, "What are we going to do with Charlie?" And Frank said, "We'll take him with him. It'll be good." So that was my first taste of running around with Frank Sheeran in mob-controlled events. So I went with him. I went with Jimmy Lynch driving us to South Philly to a restaurant that's no longer in business called the Mona Lisa. And it was owned, Angelo Bruno had been whacked already. He's the boss of the family. And his replacement also got whacked. And now the boss was a Sicilian named John Stanfa. And I walked into this restaurant. It was the only time I was really personally scared the whole time I was with Frank. We walk into the restaurant, and somebody hits the deadbolt lock behind us. The sound of that lock went right through.
Yeah, now it's a party.
Yeah, I'm looking at killers in the room. They're killers, And it turns out what it was a civil lawsuit. Frank had complained that when he went to jail, there were two guys collecting a loan shark money for him on his behalf, and they claimed that they gave that money to little Nicky Scarfo, who had been the boss at that time, and Nicky was in jail serving four life sentences for ordering hits. And Nicky revealed from prison that they did not give him the money. So they were on trial. And Sheeran was represented by Big Billy D'Elia, who was Russell Bufalino's underboss. And John Stanfa's underboss represented the other two men who were the two defendants in the case. And Stanfa was the judge. So I'm sitting there at the bar, and they're right next to the table next to me. And I'm listening to this trial, It was such a hoot. And it was so different for me because as a homicide investigator and as a homicide prosecutor, I handled state cases. The true crimes in America really are not handled by the feds. In fact, until more recently, when the feds got RICO jurisdiction of mob murders, the only jurisdiction the FBI had in murder cases was murder that occurred in a national park or a murder that occurred on an Indian reservation. 95% and more of the crimes in America were then and are now the province of local jurisdictions, district attorneys, state police, city police, county police. And
back then, you did the work that they got the credit, basically.
Well, you know, I don't know, but they got credit for whatever it was that they did, but they certainly didn't handle the rapes and the murders that occur. We just handled them and, you know, got credit for them. We didn't have time to think about it. We were so busy. It was a crime wave in the early 70s that was just incredible. America had never experienced anything like it. And we never left that crime wave. I got news. Despite the statistics that show there are less murders, well, there should be a hell of a lot less murders. We got 911. Everybody's got a cell phone. You know, what was a murder then would maybe be a bullet in the abdomen, and you would die. You know, it would take so long to get you to a hospital. There was no 911 to call. And when an ambulance came, the only qualification that the ambulance driver had was that he was a fast driver. Now they come with a whole medical team, you know, when they come upon a shooting, you know. So so many people that would have died in 1965, let's say, in 1975 even, so many of those people today survive and are not listed as murder victims. But anyway, I'm getting carried away here. But
well, no, this is fascinating, though. I mean, just the time period and the feelings and everything. This is really fascinating. Yeah, we've got about my goodness, we only have about 11 minutes left. Okay, wow. Let's skip forward if we can, because we could do this. We could listen all night long. But
well, bless you, I appreciate it.
Well, you know, and again, we're talking with Mr. Charles Brand. His book, I Heard You Paint Houses, 2016 edition, updated 57-page conclusion. His website, charlesbrandauthor.com. Highly recommend all of his books, from I Heard You Paint Houses to The Right to Remain Silent, especially that it's relevant today. Let's move up to Jimmy Hoffa himself, the conditions surrounding his disappearance, if you don't mind, if that's all right.
No.
Just kind of walk us through that situation. Okay.
Sure. Well, Jimmy was put in jail in 1967 by Bobby Kennedy, the efforts of Bobby Kennedy as Attorney General under his brother John F. Kennedy, President Kennedy. Well, once President Kennedy was killed on November 22nd, 1963, Bobby Kennedy's reign as Attorney General was about to end because Lyndon Johnson didn't like him and Bobby was committed to get the mafia. He was committed to get Jimmy Hoffa. He had formed a squad called the Get Hoffa Squad for labor racketeering and whatever he could get Hoffa on. And he finally did. And after Hoffa, in 1964, Bobby Kennedy ran and successfully for the Senate in New York. And that was the end of the crusade against the mafia. In 1967, all of Hoffa's appeals had run out, and he ended up going to jail, Lewisburg Prison in Pennsylvania. In 1970 the mafia bribed then-President Richard Nixon to get Hoffa released. And when Hoffa was released, there were restrictions placed on his pardon. They paid one section of the mafia paid $500,000 to Attorney General John Mitchell, and that was delivered by Frank Sheeran himself, that first $500,000. The second $500,000 that came in with the request that a restriction be put on Hoffa so that he not run for president of the Teamsters again. You know, the Teamsters pension fund was the mafia's bank. They used it to build Las Vegas, loans galore. Under Hoffa, all the loans were secured and they were paid. Under his successor, Frank Fitzsimmons, who was scared to death of the mafia and didn't have Hoffa's guts, the successor let the mafia walk all over him and have unsecured loans, have loans that weren't fully collateralized, and they just had a field day with, it was a billion-dollar fund, which in those days, I don't know what $1 billion in 1970 was, today's dollars, but, you know, it was a lot of money. And
a bunch.
And the pension fund was the second largest lender in the United States for land deals. The largest was Chase Bank, you know. So Hoffa gets out, and he swears that he's going to fight the restrictions on his pardon. He knows that they were put there by friends of Frank Fitzsimmons to keep Hoffa from running. He knows that he's going to win his legal battle, because while the President of the United States has the power to pardon, he doesn't have the power to put a restriction on the pardon and restrict someone's life after they get out. You can pardon, and that's all the Constitution allows you to do. So everybody knew that Hoffa was going to win. But Hoffa was a very belligerent guy, and he kept, not only am I going to win, but I'm going to expose the corruption under Fitzsimmons and how the mafia got a stranglehold. Now, the mafia never really had a stranglehold when Hoffa ran things, but they and they worked through Russell Bufalino. So if you're, say, Tony Provenzano, a mafia capo in the Genovese family, and you want to get a loan for a restaurant, friend of yours, or somebody that's paying you under the table to get the loan, you wouldn't go to the pension fund. You'd go to Russell Bufalino, and Bufalino would arrange it. So here was Hoffa out there talking imprudently. Sheeran said he was just puffing. Hoffa was not going to expose anybody, but the mafia couldn't take that chance. And so Hoffa's biggest enemy in the mafia was that Tony Provenzano I just mentioned a little while ago. And so a fake meeting was arranged for Detroit, where Hoffa lived. And Hoffa thought he was going to be meeting, that he and Frank Sheeran were going to be meeting with Tony Giacalone of Detroit, who was a personal friend of Hoffa's, and Tony Provenzano was going to come in from New Jersey, and they were going to square this beef and get Provenzano behind Hoffa and in support, and Provenzano controlled a number of delegates to the election. And Hoffa showed up to the meeting and was picked up in a car, taken to a house where he thought the meeting was going to take place. And as soon as he walked in, he was shot behind the ear twice.
And so, I think it should be, yeah, I think it should be pointed out too. And Frank Sheeran was and Jimmy Hoffa, good friends, lifetime friends, as you put it. And yep. I believe didn't Jimmy Hoffa believe that Frank, the actual killer, was there to protect him? Was there as his bodyguard?
Yeah, that's what he thought.
Boy,
and that's the way it was arranged, that Frank would be there as the Hoffa man. And then Frank and I treated him right. I rented a Cadillac, and I drove Frank to Detroit. And he nodded off, and we approached Detroit, and I could see the skyline. And so I woke him up, and I said, "Frank, there's the Detroit skyline." And I woke him up out of his sleep. And he said to me, "You got a piece?" I said, "A piece?" He said, "Yeah, you got a piece, a P-I-E-C-E, piece." I said, what would I be doing with a piece, Frank? He said, "Look, Emmett," his prior lawyer, "Emmett keeps a piece in his glove compartment. You're allowed to have a piece." What are you talking about, Frank? He said, there's people in this town that were friends of Jimmy, and they know I was on the other side of this thing. He scared the piss out of me. I'm picturing old mobsters in wheelchairs coming after us, you know, with guns blazing. So he still was spooked just by this trip to Detroit. What we were there for was to find the house. He remembered where it was. We found the exact house. And we didn't go in it. We published the book. We took a picture of the house from the outside. And once we got in it, I was led in it. Frank was already had died. I was led in it by Eric Shawn of Fox News. He flew me to Detroit. He was doing a story on it, and I got into the house, and it was exactly as Frank Sheeran had described it. You know, you walk in,
this is amazing.
There's a staircase, and to your right is a living room. And as soon as Hoppe walked in, he didn't smell any cigar smoke. He didn't smell any Italian food. This was not a meeting. And he turned to leave. And if he saw the pistol in Frank's hand, he would have thought that Frank had it out in self-defense and in defense of Hoppe. And as he brushed past
Tragic
Frank,
what a miscalculation that was. Okay, so that's where Jimmy Hoppe met his end, and at the hand of Frank Sheeran.
Correct.
And it's interesting. It's interesting how the character development in your book. We're just short on time. You really capture the essence, the fact that Frank was raised as a Roman or as a Catholic, and you know, the tough upbringing. In the fact that he had to unburden himself, you know, and thinking that, hey, if there's a God,
I was raised Catholic, and I used that on him, you know. The last thing he did before he killed himself, he agreed to, everything was on audio tape, and he agreed to give me a videotape at the end when it was in galley form, and a few months before its publication, he agreed to give me a videotape. And after the videotape, he asked that we say a Hail Mary and an Our Father together, which we did. He then asked to see the priest. We were in a hospital. He was there for a test because he had some pain in his abdomen. It turned out there was nothing wrong with him. He just had a reaction to the medicine that he was on. And so he asked for the priest, and the priest in the hospital came and gave him absolution and the Holy Communion. And then he was transported back to the assisted living nursing home kind of operation that he was living in at the time. And he just refused all food. He wouldn't take another drop.
And he passed away.
And killed himself.
That's right. So, and you were a pallbearer at his funeral, actually.
I was, absolutely. Casket was green for Ireland, you know. On the same page we are on Paddy's Day.
Interesting questions.
Mr. Brandt.
Wow.
We have reached the end of the hour.
Quick hour.
Was so fast. Again, Mr. Brandt's book, I Heard You Paint Houses, his website, charlesbrandtauthor.com.
You know, I'd love to have a cup of coffee with you one day. I'll buy you a coffee and we'll sit and we'll talk.
You bet. Where are you guys physically
located? Share some
stories.
Northwest Pennsylvania, not far from your Delaware. Well, far enough, but closer to your Delaware.
Erie,
Pennsylvania. That's right.
Yeah, that was Russell's territory. Part of Russell's.
Oh, I know,
fact,
I know, and you know we know some of the same people.
Oh wow! Deli Manorino.
We could talk all night about this. My brother, thank you so very much. We're at the end of the program. I apologize. It's just gone too, it's just been too short, but, do come back and, we'll be in touch. I just want to say thank you so very much for your gift of time.
You guys. Bye bye.
God bless. All right. Bye bye. Folks, that'll do it for us. Have a safe weekend. Good night and God bless.